Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Libya, UN aid agencies on Tuesday insisted that they are working tirelessly to get aid to where it's needed most, while preventing the spread of COVID-19 there amid continuing violence. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, the country has 8 confirmed cases of the disease, 6 in Misrata and 2 in Tripoli, and more than 100 suspected cases. Spokesperson Jens Laake said that clashes between the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, or GNA, and the Libyan National Army, LNA, and COVID-19 restriction measures were hampering humanitarian access and the movement of medical and other humanitarian personnel. The new coronavirus has already disrupted global shipping and air supply chains, which millions of people in crisis rely on around the world, Mr. Laake explained.
We are asking individual countries for exemptions to movements of essential personnel that needs to move. That is a country-level negotiation that is going on.
To help stem the spread of the virus, OCHA has delivered critical supplies, including sterile gloves and gowns, surgical masks and caps, and hand disinfecting gels. To Syria now, where the emergence of the new coronavirus has prompted changes to aid deliveries there by the World Food Programme, or WFP, to protect people from infection. The agency provides life-saving food to 4.5 million people in the war-ravaged country each month. It estimates that nearly 8 million people are food insecure and already extremely vulnerable after 9 years of conflict. It says that a nutritious and sufficient diet necessary to strengthen their immune system will soon be beyond the reach of many. Spokesperson Elizabeth Beers said in Geneva that WFP is now increasing the number of distributions it makes during daylight hours and encouraging social distancing by families receiving aid at distribution points. It has also set up hand-washing stations and uses mobile phone text messages to notify families when they should come to collect their supplies, and driving rations as close to families' homes as possible. In Salheen, a destroyed neighbourhood of Aleppo, WFP has warned there that people are more vulnerable than ever, as COVID-19 precautions have prevented them from earning their usual daily or weekly pay. The agency said that many families are increasingly forced to reduce the number of meals and portion sizes they eat, or sell their livestock and assets to purchase food. Finally, to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, where populations that are just emerging from a 20-month-long Ebola epidemic are now facing the new coronavirus. According to the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, the disease has exposed the fact that the country's health system can barely provide even basic services such as routine immunization. Some 3 million children in DRC have unmet vital health needs, UNICEF says, and more than 9 million youngsters require humanitarian assistance. In Kinshasa, Edouard Begbeder, UNICEF DR Congo representative, confirmed that eastern provinces of the vast country have recorded about 100 confirmed cases of infection and 8 deaths.
Coronavirus will most likely divert the available national health capacity and resources and leave millions of children affected by measles, malaria, polio, and many other killer diseases.
Last year, DRC experienced the world's worst measles epidemic, which killed more than 5,000 children under the age of 5, according to a new UNICEF report on life support. The country was also unable to prevent more than 30,000 cases of cholera in 2019 and more than 500 deaths, while 16.5 million people contracted malaria last year, resulting in nearly 17,000 deaths. Strengthening the DRC's basic healthcare system is vital, Mr. Begbeder insisted. Unless health facilities have the means to deliver immunization, nutrition and other essential services, including in remote areas of the country, we risk seeing the lives and futures of many Congolese children scarred or destroyed by preventable diseases, he said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Now, if I asked you to do some great heroic thing to save someone's life, like splash through the ice and take out a drowning child from the lake, a lot of you would do that. And you have that opportunity today. Today you can save a life. And for a lot of us, all we have to do is stay at home. No great hard thing.
Dr. John Campbell, coronavirus. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
Coronavirus. What can you do, and how can this nightmare end? popular UK nurse teacher Dr. John Campbell's tips. Paul Beckwith says Canada blundered into disaster on COVID, and clearing air could release 25 years worth of warming this spring or summer. I'm Alex Smith. Here we go. Dr. John Campbell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, no doubt we're going to talk about many countries, but I'd like to start with your own. In the middle of March, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson suggested COVID-19 was not all that serious. The government would let the disease burn through the population until some sort of herd immunity was reached, he suggested. Well, of course, hundreds of scientists and medical professionals objected, and that deadly idea barely lasted a weekend. But as in the United States, valuable time has been lost as the leadership doesn't seem to get the population to self-isolate in time. So now, what was the situation in the UK by the end of March?
Yeah, you raise an absolutely vital point, Alec. I mean, throughout this, governments have been reactive rather than proactive. Now that particular statement by the Prime Minister was based on medical advice at the time. And I think this just shows the way that even amongst the senior medical officers, understanding of this virus has been evolving. And what actually happened in that case in particular was the chief scientific officer and the chief medical officer gave advice to the Prime Minister, which he then followed. But then other modellers, particularly the Imperial College London, who specialise in a lot of epidemiological modelling, said that if this model was followed, there would be just a horrendous peak and an appalling number of cases. Because what seems to be happening globally from data in China, from data from Italy, it seems that of every 100 people that get the COVID-19 infection that have been diagnosed, around about 12 of those are going to need some form of treatment because they can be quite severely ill. And of those, about 5% can be critical. So if the government had carried on following that program, what would have happened is, you're right in saying that herd immunity would have developed fairly quickly, but millions of people would have got infected and millions of people would be infected all at the same time. And if you want to work out what the percentages are, if it was 10 million people who were infected all at the same time, and 12% were very poorly and 5% were critically ill, then you can see from that no health service in the world could possibly look after that number of people. So that sort of thinking evolved fairly quickly. But it is a pity that governments have been reacting to things rather than being proactive, because this gives the virus time to go from individual cases to clusters to community spread. And very often by the time dramatic shutdown measures like we're now seeing with about a quarter of the world's population, by the time that happens, very often there's established community spread, and that makes it all the more difficult to get the number of cases down again.
Yes, even after more than a week of pretty complete lockdown, there were shocking high death counts in Italy. Did the lockdown fail?
No, that's an excellent question. The incubation period for this disease is typically 5, 6, or 7 days, and we say 2 to 14 days. So if there was a lot of community transmission just before the start of a lockdown, then that means there's a backlog of cases which are incubating through the start of the lockdown. So the lockdown started, but cases still keep rising because the incubation period is resulting in more people, as it were, coming out the end of this pipeline that are becoming infected. And as well as that, deaths tend to occur in the second, third, fourth, or even fifth week after the onset of symptoms. So cases can carry on rising and deaths can carry on rising for some time after the lockdown. But this virus will only survive in the respiratory tract of human beings. It's the only place it can reproduce. And if we stop it spreading from one respiratory tract to another, the virus ends with that person when one person develops immunity. We can break these chains of transmission. And this top-down approach, this community shutdown, this social physical distancing is one way to do that. Now, I think in Italy, for the past 4 days now, we're talking about the end, towards the end of March now, the past 4 days, there's been a decrease in the percentage increase of new cases in Italy. Now, that means the total number is still increasing, of course, but the rate of increasing is now slowing down. And with the lockdown continuing, we would expect that to go down to no new cases, and then we would expect the number of cases to start falling off, perhaps about 3 weeks into the lockdown. So lockdown is a strategy where we have to be patient and wait for the benefits to come out. But they will come out. I believe strongly they will come out. So I believe strongly that the number of cases in Italy and Spain will start to drop in the next week or two. And in my country, where the lockdown has just started, I believe the number of cases will start to drop in about 2 weeks' time. And I believe it's essential that we do this. Otherwise, we're going to have a glut of very ill people all at the same time. And we will not be able to cope with that.
Well, as you know, this situation is very hard to predict because there are doubling times every 2 days in some countries in the number of cases and deaths a few weeks after that. But given we're speaking at the end of March, what is your prognosis for the situation in New York City?
The lockdown in New York is now becoming more and more effective. So if that lockdown is obeyed by the majority of people, that will break the chain of transmission. But this is going to be expensive in terms of economy and in terms of lifestyle. So what happens in New York City depends on the people of New York City. If they obey this lockdown and they do not socialize, they do not go to their friend's house for a drink, they do not go out for meals, they do not invite their friends around for a game of cards, they do always maintain a 2 meter distance, especially in indoor environments. They do maintain good personal hygiene. They are careful to wash their hands when they come in. If they obey all of these things, then given that this strategy has recently started, I would expect the cases to carry on increasing for the next week or two. But if this is obeyed, then I would expect the number of cases, as appears to be happening in Italy, to start to go down now. But if this is not obeyed, if people carry on interacting as they have been in the past, then the number of cases will carry on increasing, and the number of critical cases will also carry on increasing. Now, even where we are, specifically in New York situation, at the moment, there's 3,000 critical care beds available in New York City. It's estimated that in about 2 to 3 weeks' time, that when this current wave of the outbreak will probably peak, given the shutdown measures we've seen in New York, they're going to need 30,000 critical care beds to look after this 5% of the population that's going to be in critical need. And it's really quite hard to see about how that is happening. So if that doesn't happen, what that will mean is the case fatality rate, the percentage of people that die per 100 of people that are infected, is tragically going to increase. So it very much depends on the behavior of everyone. Everyone has to realize that everyone has a role to play in this. And if they start socializing with their friends, that could essentially be condemning someone else to death. We really must socially isolate, meticulous hygiene, and we need to flatten this curve. We need to stop the increase in the rate of growth. But we won't see the benefits of that for about 2 weeks. It has to work through the incubation period.
We have seen videos from weeping doctors in Italy and in Spain saying that they had to do a triage to make a decision, and basically no one over the age of 65 would get a ventilator until they could get more ventilators. And I don't know whether those have been, you know, whether those are credible reports, but it sounds possible that many major cities may come to that point if we can't get a grip on this.
Yes. This is not something that's unknown to intensive care medicine anyway. Before someone goes into intensive care, they're usually assessed in some detail by one or two senior doctors, very often an intensivist and an anaesthetist. And they decide if this person can benefit from intensive care, because not everyone benefits from intensive care. It's a very high-risk procedure anyway. If you or me, as healthy people at the moment, walk into an intensive care unit and we were ventilated for a week or two, then our chances of dying from that wouldn't be insignificant, and that's walking in healthy. So intensive care is actually quite a high-risk procedure, so it's always necessary to be careful about who it's appropriate to give intensive care to. But the situation in Italy, while they are doing that to a large extent, they are prioritising those that will benefit from patient care. The sheer weight of numbers has meant, and these reports are credible, and I have heard them from other sources, that doctors are having to essentially decide who gets ventilated or not when two patients would both potentially benefit from intensive care. And what they seem to be doing, from anecdotal thoughts, I haven't got any definitive evidence on this, But it does make perfect sense that they're saying people over the age of 65 have to give way to people under the age of 65 for prioritisation for ventilators. This is just a completely heart-wrenching decision for any clinician. And the other tragedy in that situation is because the people in the intensive care unit and the very poor people are infected, their relatives can't go in to be with them. So we have this tragic situation where people are denied the intensive medical care that could potentially save their lives, not necessarily, but potentially. And then they can't have their loved ones around them when they die. So that just upsets the whole dying process. It upsets the whole grieving process for the relatives as well. And it's just an appalling situation, but it's one which resources allow no alternative but to make at the moment. It's an appalling situation. And it just shows the importance of preventing the community spread, so we prevent too many people all being ill at the same time.
John Campbell, do you have any insight into why the reported deaths in Germany are so much lower than in neighboring European countries, even though they have thousands and thousands of cases?
Yes, it's an excellent question. The German health authorities have very good health facilities throughout Germany, and they have quite a lot of critical care facility. So for the number of cases that they've had in Germany, up until very recently, they have been able to provide quite a lot of health care for these people. And if you can provide good health care, you can reduce the case fatality rate. And the other factor in Germany is Germany have been reactive in terms of social shutdown. They haven't had as much social shutdown as I would like to have been. But what they've been more proactive with in Germany is the testing, and there's been quite a lot of testing. Now, if you can only test a small amount of your population, so, for example, if 10 people die and you've tested 100 people to diagnose 100 people, that will give you a death rate of 10%, because 10% of the people that have been tested positive die. But if you can test a lot more people, as you have done in Germany, so if you can test 1,000 people and you still find 10 of those die, then that brings your death rate down to 0.1%. So the more people you test, and we know that most people actually get a fairly mild form of this disease, so the more people you test, the more people you diagnose, the relatively smaller the case fatality rate in terms of percentages. So I think they're the two main factors in Germany. And there's cause for hope there as well, because when we get more testing, it may well be that in my country, for example, there could have been tens of thousands of people who are infected already. We simply don't know. And if that's the case, so we think there's maybe about 10,000 people infected now, but if it turns out there's been 100,000 people infected, then that would make the case fatality rate 100 times lower, which would be remarkably good news. So I think they're the two factors that are giving the impression that the death rate is lower in Germany. But I think the actual virulence of the disease and the nature of the virus is basically the same in Germany. And as well as that, I would expect the death rate in Germany to carry on rising, unfortunately, as well.
From what we've seen so far, John, do you think it's realistic to expect a pause in this disease in the Northern Hemisphere during this summer?
This disease does not seem to have a great degree of seasonality, and the reason I believe that is because it seems to be spreading in hotter countries, so southern China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, and now unfortunately places like South Africa seem to have community spread, and indeed quite a few places in Africa seem to have community spread. And of course these countries are much warmer than the Northern Hemisphere is, even at the height of summer. So I don't think we're going to get a seasonality effect like we get with influenza. One thing that will reduce the spread, though, in the Northern Hemisphere as the weather gets warmer is people do not spend so much time with the windows shut indoors, so they're not as close together in as close proximity, and they spend more time in the fresh air. So that might reduce the spread somewhat. But what I think is going to happen is the shutdown measures that have been implemented now all over Northern Europe are going to start to be effective in the next few weeks, and we will see a reduction in cases. Now, if these measures had not been implemented, then I think over the next year, about 50, 60, who knows, maybe 70% of the population of Northern Europe and North America would have been infected with this virus. So these lockdown measures are absolutely essential. But they're very difficult to carry on for economic and social reasons. We can't really carry on these lockdown measures until we get a vaccine, which might be perhaps in the summer of 2021. So what we need to do is attack this disease from underneath as well with massively increased testing. And then we have massively increased testing. We can just, as I've already said, isolate the people that are infected. And that can allow most people to go back to work. And the other thing about the increased testing is that we're bringing out, I know my government's ordered 3.5 million of these to start with, where we actually test for the antibody. And the antibody is the test for the immune protein that the body makes in response to the virus. And someone will have that when they've recovered, perhaps for a year or 2 years, or perhaps for decades, or maybe even for life. We don't know yet after they've had the virus. But that means if someone has got that antibody, it means they've had the virus, and then it's very likely, in fact, we believe strongly that that person would then be immune to the virus and then could go back to normal duties without the risk of infecting other people.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Scientists in China reported live COVID-19 virus was found in fecal matter, so we need to be careful how we clean and dispose of that. But the burning question for me is, can this virus be transmitted in the air? What do we know so far?
Two good points. There's no question that the virus has been cultured and can be transmitted from feces. And there's evidence that when a toilet is flushed, there can be an aerosolization effect of the virus from the feces if the lid of the toilet is not put down. And there's also been, the virus has also been isolated from sewage. So that is certainly the case. Now, the question about the aerosolization of the virus is one that is still an ongoing debate. First of all, let's say what we know for sure. What we know for sure is this is a droplet infection. The virus is shed from the respiratory lining of people's respiratory tracts that are infected. It gets into their mucus and then they cough it up. And that virus goes out of the body in droplets. And those droplets can either go into someone else's eyes, nose or mouth infection, or those droplets can fall down with gravity onto a surface, which an uninfected person then touches with their hands and transmits the virus from their hands into their face, into their mucous membranes. That's why hand hygiene is so critical in this and social distancing is so critical. Now, the difference between a droplet infection and an aerosolized infection is the size of the water particles in which the virus can live. So when someone sneezes, for example, there's a vast range in size of the droplets that are sneezed out from really quite microscopic to what you can actually see. If you were sneezed onto your computer screen, for example. So there's a big range. And there's not like a strict cutoff between an infection that is droplet infection and an infection that is aerosol infection. And it seems to me from cumulative data that we've got that this is somewhere between. So for example, on the Diamond Princess, it looks like this was the cruise ship that was in Yokohama and quarantined. Well over 700 people got infected on that ship. And it looks like many of those got infected through the air conditioning because a lot of the inside cabins have no windows. So the people were dependent on circulated air from the ship to be able to have fresh air in their cabins. So it looks like there was aerosolization spread there with smaller droplets. And also there's some evidence that there's been aerosolization spread in air conditioner units where you get these smaller droplets potentially going from office to office. Now, there's still ongoing debate about this, but I think what we can be fairly clear about is it's not going to be spread dramatically in the open air. So it's not going to blow in the wind from village to village or from house to house. But in enclosed environments, some people are believing that the virus can be suspended in the air for 3 hours in closed, poorly ventilated environments. Now, even if the final data transpires to show that's only for 3 or 4 minutes, that would indicate some aerosolization has spread and shows how critically important it is not to be too close to people, especially in poorly ventilated areas. So it seems to be between the standard droplet infection and the aerosolized infection. Quite where it is on that continuum, we don't really know yet.
Suppose the hospitals are overwhelmed. They can't take any more patients, or it just seems too dangerous to go there, and we have a very sick person at home. What would a seasoned nurse do to give that person the best chances of survival at home?
It's remarkably difficult to give proper medical care at home. Now, for the vast majority of people, it's just going to be a matter of lying around, feeling awfully ill for a few days, and then getting better. Now, one of the risk factors in this disease is pneumonia. And in nursing, we've always known that people with pneumonia and potential chest infection should be nursed sitting up. So having these patients lie down, especially lying on their back, would be a bad idea. So if possible, we want people to sit up. And we want to encourage coughing and expectoration to get as much sputum out as possible. To get as much oxygen into the body, if we don't have any oxygen supply, then there's going to be higher concentrations of oxygen in fresh air outside of the house than there is inside the house. So we could sit them up near an open window as long as it wasn't too cold for them. And also, we want the mucus in their lungs to remain as mobile as possible. What we don't want is for the mucus to dry out. So if the person becomes dehydrated, again, it will be harder for them to clear the mucus, making pneumonia and these other severe complications more likely. So drinking plenty of fluids would be a good idea. And the other thing that is sometimes of benefit that we also do in critical care situations, for example, is for an hour or two at a time, we'll nurse patients prone, which basically means lying on their tummy as opposed to lying on their back. So it may be, we don't really know, but it may be that some time lying on the tummy, alternating with time sitting up, would be a good idea. And that brings us on to another debate. The whole nature of a fever. To me, the reason the body generates a fever is there's quite specific physiological mechanisms that generate a fever. A fever is not some accident. It's the body deliberately increasing the body temperature to reduce the ability of the viruses to reproduce and also to optimize the functioning of the body's own immune system. So when you take a drug like acetaminophen, Tylenol, or as we call it in this country, paracetamol, that's going to reduce the fever. Now, that will make you feel an awful lot better because the fever makes you feel sick. But again, in my view, that's going to reduce the efficiency of the immune system. So if I was in a situation where I couldn't access medical care, personally, I would not take fever reducers. I would feel awful, but I would leave my fever as it was. I think people need to think twice about reducing fever as readily as we do because fever is a natural part of the body's defense mechanisms. But they're going to have to make their own decisions on that and ideally talk to their own doctors. But that's what I do for me personally, but I can't prescribe for your viewers. Apart from that, there's very little that you can do at home and maintain good nutrition. When you're acutely ill, if you feel hungry, eat. If you don't feel hungry, don't force yourself to eat. But just make sure you take in plenty of fluids. And if you do feel you're deteriorating and then you're really not being able to breathe effectively, then you really do need to take external medical advice about that.
We all want to know how this nightmare could possibly end. I can think of several ways that we talked about getting a vaccine within a year and a half, even 2 years. We don't know. Or the earlier idea of it will just rush through the population and the survivors will have immunity. How can this end, John?
In a civilized society, I don't think we can possibly say we just have to let this go. We're going to accept 5% people being critically ill who might not get treatment. That's just not an acceptable option. We have to carry on with the lockdown measures, and we absolutely have to massively increase testing. Now, when we do that, we can control the epidemic. And you're right, more and more people will get the infection. Most people will have a mild illness, and the herd immunity will increase. And if we have the testing, we will know who has immunity and who doesn't, so we can moderate our behaviour accordingly. So instead of these blanket lockdowns, we can have much more targeted lockdown of the population. And that means that everything can carry on much more normally than it would if we had this blanket lockdown. So I would see the future as being carrying on with the lockdown until we can massively increase testing, then have the strategy of selective lockdown and massive testing for the rest of this year. But this pandemic is only going to go away when there's no more people left for it to infect. That's the only time it's actually going to finish. And the only times there's going to be no more people left for it to infect is if people have immunity. And there's only two ways people can get immunity. That is by having the disease themselves or by being vaccinated. So unfortunately, I do not believe the world is going to be rid of this pandemic until we have an effective vaccine for it. And that may well be summer 2021. Now, even if that happens for summer 2021, that is going to be far and away the quickest vaccine that has ever been developed in the history of humanity and would represent a major triumph for medical science. But I believe that is attainable. Until then, we have to carry on with the lockdown strategies, increasing testing, and then selective isolation and quarantine for those that are testing positive, with greater freedom for those that have the antibody that we know are now immune to the disease. That's the only way it can end, when there are no more people it can infect.
Yes, I suppose once we have tests that really show who has immunity, then they could go back to work at critical jobs and try and keep things running until we get the vaccine on board. Now, John Campbell, you and I are prime targets for the worst of this disease. We are men over the age of 65. What measures are you taking to protect you and yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm 62 at the moment, so in the 60 to 70-year-old age group, the probability of death in China when you caught that infection was 3.6%. Now, I'm actually retired from professional healthcare at the moment, but pretty soon I'm going to have to decide whether I go back and do some work as a staff nurse on A&E. It may be that I decide my work as an academic is actually worth carrying on, and I'll carry on with the videos and do that from home. But what I'm doing at the moment is the same as everyone else. So in the UK now, we are totally locked down. We are not going to our friends' houses. Our friends are not coming here. Only myself and my wife are in the house. So we go for walks once a day together. We're allowed out once a day for a walk. If we do walk and we meet friends, we make sure we keep 2 meters apart from them. I am not going to see my parents. I'm not going to see my children. I'm not going to see my grandson. We have to be socially isolated from absolutely everyone. Whenever we've been out, we have to practice meticulous hygiene. So I take my shoes off when I come in the house. And I wash my hands properly and clinically when I come in. And I dry them on a kitchen roll and throw that away. If I'm outside, I'm very careful not to cough or sneeze at anyone. Fortunately, I don't have a cold or anything at the moment, so that's not particularly a problem. But I'm careful I don't go within 2 meters of anyone, so I'm not even breathing on them. So these are all the common sense measures that we can take. Basically, you don't go out of the house or the garden or wherever you live unless you've got a good reason to do so. So it's only essential food shopping, going to care for vulnerable people, or going out for exercise once a day. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to separate the idea here of social isolation from physical isolation. So we have to be physically isolated, but socially close. So we need to keep talking to people. Think about your area. Think about people that might be isolated and call them up, talk to them on the internet, or you could even shout at them through a glass window. That would be absolutely fine, as long as there's a physical separation. But just making sure that people don't feel alone, even when they're physically isolated. Other than that, we're just waiting for testing coming on board, which is going to be the next way we're going to attack this pandemic while we wait for the vaccine.
As we wrap up here, John, do you have any closing message for our listeners?
We need to carry on social isolation. We have to obey what the authorities are telling us to do. We must not work out ways to flout the rules. We have to go with this. This is something we have to do all together. We have to move forward collectively. Me being silly, me going out to meet some friends or going around to a friend's house or something like that could result in some other more vulnerable person or potentially even me dying from this condition. There are no higher stakes here. We have to cooperate with this. And we have to wait for the testing and we have to wait for the vaccine. But we have to realize that everyone has a role to play and we have to comply with this. It's difficult in the short term, but the better we do it, the shorter time we'll have to do it for. So let's all comply with this, go together and beat this virus. And we will beat it. This pandemic will go with the shutdown, with the testing, and finally with the vaccination. We'll be over and we're going to bounce back. And let's hope we both bounce back into a wiser, more civilized, more learned form of humanity.
From Britain, we have been speaking with nurse trainer and now online teacher to the world, Dr. John Campbell. Thank you, John, for your help in this urgent hour.
You're welcome, Alex. Thank you for having me again. Very kind of you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Great to get you again, Paul. Now, I called to discuss your three-part video on whether we can expect extreme heat events as the industrial shutdown lowers air pollution, and I think that could happen myself, and it is important. But first, you just blew me away by predicting Canada is not an oasis from the corona pandemic developing just south of the border in the States. You say Canadians made colossal blunders that could cost us dearly in weeks to come. Paul, why don't you begin by explaining that old adage from the Middle Ages about travel and the plague?
Yes, well, ancient knowledge says that if you're in your country and a plague comes, stay in your country, stay at home. And if you're in a foreign country and a plague comes there, then don't go home, stay where you are. That's, that's an old, I think it's Arabic. I think it's from the Middle East. You know, it's really common sense, right? I mean, you don't want to bring plagues to other countries if it's in your country.
But that's not what we're doing at all. I mean, you noted that 1 in 37 Canadians, about 3% of the population, return from March holidays from Florida or the snowbirds coming home from the U.S. Southwest and from their Mexican winter holidays. And as far as I can tell, none of them were tested or questioned or quarantined on their return. What is the risk for Canadians?
I think the risk is extremely high because, as we know, the U.S. has done totally inadequate and insufficient testing. They're scrambling to try to catch up now, but there were many, many people that were carrying the virus. You know, first of all, it's very difficult to stop it spreading globally because you can get it and you cannot have symptoms. You may never have symptoms or they may appear after a week. So how do you stop something like that with our global travel? There's over 1 million Canadians that returned to Canada, most by air, some by land across the border. It's over 1 million, and it was between March 10th and March 14th. And, you know, I'm sure many of these people are carriers, you know, whether or not they have the symptoms, and they brought it back to Canada. And, over the next few weeks, we're certainly going to find out what happened. Now, Travelers, Trudeau's has been ratcheting up. You know, the Canadian government's been ratcheting up their restrictions, and they just today, maybe they watched my video, I don't know, yesterday, because today they put mandatory quarantine into place. I mean, there's reports of people hiding their symptoms so they could return back to Canada. They're coughing and they were ill, but, you know, at the airport, they just squeeze through, don't cough when you're talking to the customs person, you know, load up on water or whatever and say you're perfectly fine and you get back into Canada. Of course, many people who were visiting for March break went down to, beaches and so on. You could see all the people in Florida that were totally disobeying any physical separation. You know, they crowded the beaches, and I'm sure there are many young Canadians there. You know, young people, for a start, they don't feel the same risk that, older people do. And it turns out that many young people are getting just as sick, and, the strains of the virus are changing and so on. So Trudeau's been urging Canadians to come back, and they closed the border last week, but that excluded Canadians. Canadians could just come back. So, you know, the government needs to track and find out, get a handle on all those people and where they are, and that's not happening, right? These people are told to self-isolate for 14 days. But my mother-in-law in Oshawa, she said, a friend of hers just drove back from the U.S. about a week ago and stayed at home for a couple of days and was at the grocery store and called my mother-in-law and said, hey, let's get together. And my mother-in-law said, well, where have you been? She said, I've been to the grocery store. I've been on hikes. I've been to my bridge club. I've done this and that. And my mother-in-law said, well, wait a minute, you're supposed to be self-isolating for 2 weeks. And this woman, you know, elderly woman said, I don't feel perfectly fine. I don't have anything. I'm invulnerable. You know, I'm healthy. I take my vitamins. And no concern for anybody else, right? So I think we're in trouble. I mean, even if those people all stay home and self-isolate, a certain fraction of them will get sick and will go into hospitals, and a fraction of 1 million people is enough to overwhelm hospitals wherever they go. And then those hospitals aren't available to supply the critical care to patients that are ill but have nothing to do with the disease. you know, it cascades. But presumably those people, many of them won't do the self-quarantine and they'll spread the virus. So, you know, areas where they come back, I think there's an awful lot from Ottawa. There's a lot in Toronto. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot all over. But I mean, the March breakers that go down to the U.S., they draw, a lot of them drive, a lot of them fly, and then they come up. And they're in Toronto, they're in Montreal, they're in cities all across Ontario and Quebec. We're in trouble. I mean, this, we haven't heeded this ancient wisdom at all.
Do you really think, though, that Canada could experience horror similar to what Italy has now, but delayed by a few weeks?
Well, if a hospital system gets swamped, then the death rate is enormous. I mean, if you consider that maybe 20% of patients, you know, get symptoms, and, you know, if 10% go in the hospital, 5% need ICU, you know, and if a couple percent need the respirators and things, then those 5% that are critically ill will die, and they won't get the help, so most of them will die. And we're talking about swamping the hospital system by a factor of 10 or something, you know, unless resources can appear to meet the demand. But our hospital systems are not, how can they be designed for plague? They can. They're designed for normal operation. And we know that they're stretched to the limit already. You hear stories of people waiting 6-7 hours in emergency. And this was months ago before there was any sign of the pandemic. So, you know, it doesn't, logically, I mean, it just doesn't look good. Now, we've learned, hopefully, some stuff from Italy. I mean, we're all under lockdown, more or less, right now. I mean, Trudeau needs to go the last step and declare an emergency. I'm sure he'll do that within a few days. But, you know, him encouraging people to come back without the monitoring, without the tracking and stuff, it's just asking for trouble. I mean, he's done a lot of things right, but this was a major blunder. You know, and I think we're going to pay for it in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, we'll see. We don't have to wait very long to see if that happens or not. But I don't see, I mean, how can it not happen? There's so many cases in the U.S. that are undiagnosed. This thing's been going around for a while.
Well, you know, and I have to feel a little sorry for us human beings because we're going through such a wrenching change and so many people just can't make that change fast enough to suit this disease. I saw a feature on the local news in the Okanagan Valley, British Columbia, and a man from the building trade said construction workers are essential workers, so they have to keep coming to work and building new condo towers in downtown Kelowna. And my God, there's nothing essential about that. And then the local farm lobby just got the Canadian government to allow 100,000 guest agricultural workers, mostly from Mexico, to come in too. We're not taking this seriously in Canada.
No, we're not. And there's I heard that there was 15,000 people in India, Canadians in India, that are anxious to come back as soon as possible. Right. And, you know, the snowbirds that have been down in Florida for months and months and months on end, you know, mingling with all of the population. This thing's been going around for a while. Yeah, we're going to be hit hard, you know, about letting in the Mexican farm workers. I mean, that's absurd. What about all the Canadians that are out of work right now? Why don't they can do the jobs in the fields if needed in the spring? We don't need to bring in 100,000 Mexicans. I'm sure there'd be lots of people that would be willing to just, you know, they're bored at home. The crucial response to this virus is the great article by Thomas
Poyo, yes.
Called Coronavirus, the Hammer and the Dance. And, you know, we need to hammer for 3 to 7 weeks, you know, cut the exponential growth, get the R value, spreading value less than 1, so it tapers off. And then we can ease up and get, you know, the economy start up again. But monitoring the R value, and as soon as, you know, if there's breakouts, then you taper back again and you suppress it. And so that's the dance part, right? But the hammer part now is what we need to do. And that doesn't involve letting in 100,000 people from Mexico to work in the field. It doesn't mean letting 15,000 people come back from India. You know, what it means is that we stop travel. We stop a movement of people from countries, and people have to stay in place and weather it, and different places will fare differently, but we can't just keep spreading it. Like, I mean, Canada's cases, I just updated it. We gained 500 cases, total confirmed cases yesterday, and we're on track for gaining about the same now. Our latest number is 3,588. The Italy is about 1,000 behind China. And that's a 2:34 p.m. today, Eastern Time update, March 26th from the Johns Hopkins virus map. Make, you know, people should Google that and have a look. It's real-time data, essentially. the U.S. will be way, you know, they'll be in the lead. Trump will be cheering. And, you know, in a few days, we're not as good as I thought we'd be because of all of these people. I mean, in China, ironically, they had the Chinese New Year, right? There's something like 330,000 Chinese people that live in Italy. About 4 or 5 years ago, there's about 60, 70,000 people that work in the luxury garment industry, you know, fancy handbags, clothes, et cetera, in Italy, the high fashion. And many of them went back to China for the Chinese New Year and then went back to Italy quickly before borders were shut down. And this is why Italy has had such a hard time of it from these outbreaks. It was spread. So now what is Canada doing? We've done exactly the same thing by only instead of 60,000 people crossing a border, it's 1 million people crossing a border, plus more people coming. So, you know, that broke Italy, what I described with the 60,000. And we have 1 million people coming across from America, and untold numbers of those people will be carrying the virus. So I hope Trudeau's thing is retroactive. It didn't sound like it to me. He said anybody now crossing the border has to self-quarantine by law and they'll be traced and stuff. What about the people that came back a week ago? They're supposed to be in another week of quarantine, and there was nothing in the announcements today about that. So I don't know what advice he's getting, but if he had some good microbiologists and virologists advising him, I mean, they have to be in charge right now.
By the end of the summer, though, Paul, we may see more internal migration in North America and perhaps in other countries as the economy collapses and families are forced to consolidate to wherever they think they can best survive what could be a long-term depression, maybe worse than the 1930s. My own kids may move back in here where our home is paid for and we can grow some food. If that internal migration happens, I think we can expect the disease to move with it. What are your thoughts, Paul?
Absolutely. The disease will move with key. You know, it's a game of probabilities, right? I mean, the less people that you have close contact with, the better. So, you know, Canadians that are living alone and don't have family, you know, they have the best chances of getting through this without getting sick, right? But most of us, you know, you have kids, you know, who's not going to take a son or daughter home, right? You know, that wants to come back, you know, that has no money to pay for the rent wherever they are. Who's not going to take them in? Families will risk getting sick, but it's only one person or two people that they're talking about. So hopefully, so it's a matter of statistics. It's a matter of probabilities. I mean, there is risk with that, but it's low. Hopefully your son or daughter that you're taking back has been taking these self-isolation precautions, et cetera. And we don't have a sense of control. You know, this virus is coming. We're kind of hunkered down. You know, if you have stocks in the stock market, they've collapsed. And your life has completely changed. The biggest complaint in Italy is not about the quarantine, is that, you know, people are forced to sleep with their own spouses.
I like a little bit of humor. Well, with that, I'd like to switch to the subject that you and I know best, climate change, which turns out has some relationships here. Now, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau just announced a $15 billion bailout package for the Canadian oil and gas sector, which is tanking. The tar sands operations are bleeding money daily. Alberta crude is selling for about $5 a barrel, about the price of a cup of coffee, and they can't produce it for four times that much. Despite the need for support from the Greens to keep on governing, it sounds to me like Trudeau's Liberals are committed to continuing to wreck the climate and not to save it, even now when we have this little chance. What do you think?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling that they're doing this. I mean, you know, they bought the pipeline. I mean, they're just making so many mistakes. Like, governments are like deer's in headlights. You know, they're just, reacting. I mean, you know, if Trump goes and opens the economy in the U.S., I don't think he can. I don't think the states will go for it. You know, this is what he's saying. I think, and the doctor, his head doctor there is not saying too much because he knows, you know, given it every day, you know, the cases are going to go up 35% or 40% in the U.S. So in a couple of days, 2, 3 days, 4 days, everything becomes so clear. I mean, this is the exponential function, which none of those politicians understand whatsoever. And, you know, I had higher hopes for Trudeau. I thought he was a smarter guy, but he's just as he's as dumb as a sack of bricks, just like the rest of the politicians. He talks a good game, but to put that type of cash into an industry, that money should be going into renewables. I mean, renewables are still operating, the solar farm. I mean, in fact, solar power is setting record levels of production because the sky is so clear now, right? So, solar efficiencies are way, way up for solar. And, wind is doing very well and all these things. I mean, that money needs to be going into that if Trudeau had any sense. Many people expected more from him. But after he bought the pipeline, we saw what he was really like, what the Liberal Party was really like. And, at least he says he follows science, but he follows the science that he wants. He doesn't. What we're going through is we've been talking about climate change and the risks to society and stuff, and it's been abrupt climate change. It's accelerating faster and faster. So now take that time scale and crank it up 100 times or something. Instead of things happening in, a decade, say, which is 120 months, they're happening in 3 months. So accelerate the time scale. So I call it coronavirus time compression. Like think what you were doing a month ago or 3 weeks ago, and it seems like it was 2 years ago and a year ago. You know what I mean? Like our sense of time is just because things are changing exponentially with the virus, and countries are reacting very, very quickly, when they're usually very, very bureaucratic and lethargic, but they're acting fairly quickly, still not quickly enough, as I'm saying. The hammer and dance needs to be done in every country immediately. I think back a week ago, and it seems, crazy. It seems more like a month or 2 months or a year ago. That's just me. I don't know.
No, I'm totally experiencing that. A day now is a month at any other time. And a Reddit post said, funny how everything they said was too extreme to do for climate change is done in an instant for COVID-19.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're talking about the green plan in the U.S., $1 trillion or $2 trillion of costing, and they pump that into the stock market in a day, and it still drops 1,000 points that day. So, I mean, this is Trump feels like he's been controlling the stock market. There's no question. I mean, he knows when it's like he says something that's going to drop it. He probably tells all of his friends, or when it's going to go up with a positive announcement. And, they're gaming the thing, but he can't do that so much here. I mean, they lowered interest rates to zero, essentially. The U.S. is completely ill-equipped to deal with this. And they're going to be, if they get away with only 500,000 or, 1 million or 2 million deaths, I think they're doing about the best they can do now. If there were 10 million deaths, when it's all over in the U.S. or 12, I wouldn't be surprised. It's very dire stuff, but unless they get their act together, they need to get Trump out of there. They need to run the country from medical experts. Most presidents would just step aside and let the experts, take over, but not him, right? He's the genius. He knows more than any experts, and he's going to do what he's going to do and be responsible directly for millions of deaths in the country. I mean, that's what it's got to in the U.S.
Meanwhile, though, as you've written about and done videos on, some apologists for the oil industry claim we must keep burning fossil fuels or the world will experience severe heat. They say global dimming is protecting us, and so we need pollution to do that. You looked into this with 3 YouTube videos. Tell us about that issue, Paul, and what you found.
I think we'll be able to pin down the numbers of how actually strong the global dimming is effect because of the virus. It looks like, with China shutting down a quarter of their industry, reducing their emissions by a quarter, you can calculate the temperature, but you have to know if industry stopped overnight, what would the temperature rise be, right? How much of the aerosols leave the atmosphere? They're rained out within a week, and then more sunlight hits the earth, more can escape to space at night, so the daily temperature range increases. And there was a study around for 9/11, planes didn't fly for 3 days, and the daily temperature range seemed to increase about a degree, half a degree warmer in the day and half a degree cooler at night because of the lack of the contrails. Of course, that's one factor of industry shutting down, flights greatly reduced. So that factor is still there. We would expect more daily temperature range with fewer, with the aircraft industry shuttered. But then it's the low-level aerosols from industry And the best number that I could see from scientific consensus was about half a degree, the total effect, but it varied between about 0.25 and 1.1 degrees Celsius. So if you take the half a degree number and you shatter a quarter of global industry, you could argue it's about a quarter of a half a degree, which is about 0.125 degrees Celsius temperature rise globally increase. That would, of course, be double on land and about half of the oceans. And then if you add, those are the direct effects from the aerosols, but then there's also the cloud physics. You know, aerosols act as cloud condensation nuclei to the water vapor clings to them and grows, and you get the particles. So cloud formation depends on that. And then if there's more aerosols, there can be more particles that are smaller, and then you can get more clouds, and that causes some of the cooling too. So maybe, you know, I doubt it would be double the effect of the direct effect, but if it was double, then we'd be talking about, you know, a rise of, yeah, half a degree at least on the land, maybe up to a degree, you know, short term. Even if it was half a degree, that's about 25 years of warming, you know, at the present rate, because we're warming globally. We're warming about 0.2 degrees per decade globally. Of course, it's way, way higher in the Arctic, as you know. And let's talk about the Arctic. Don't let me forget that, because there's some very interesting stuff coming there. But we'll find out. We should get a good grip. I mean, the studies that come out of this shuttering down of a big chunk of global industrial output, we'll be able to get the numbers on what this is. Well, I mean, there'll be some studies that come out in a few months to a year, and then we'll know that what that number is. We won't have such a uncertainty, 0.25 to 1.1. We'll be able to pin it down. And most scientists think it's about 0.5, but it could be 1, could be closer to 1.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Well, I think we're going to get extreme heat events this summer, but just from the high carbon counts we've already put into the atmosphere from previous fossil burning. But I am nervous that one or more breadbasket regions could be hit by heat or drought, endangering the world food supply. But you mentioned the Arctic. What do you think is happening there, and is this lack of global dimming going to affect the Arctic sea ice?
You know, temperatures this last winter in the Northern Hemisphere have been unbelievably, you know, warm. I mean, temperature anomalies 5 degrees Celsius over large parts of Europe and so on. And lots of people were saying, well, is this the effect coming in from the global dimming? But, you know, it was really there sort of late last year as well. So it's hard to really tease out what exactly is causing it. But we know, you know, apart from the general trends, but some people have pointed out to me, and I'll do a video hopefully later today about it, is well, there's a couple things. One is the temperature, is the seasonality of the virus. As it warms up, will the transmission go down significantly? There's a very interesting paper I found from a few years ago, and I'll do a video on that today as well. But the jet streams, interestingly enough, the polar vortex over in the Northern Hemisphere is not centered over the Arctic right now. It's centered over the center of Greenland. And that probably rings a bell with you because, you know, it was at least a year and a half ago, I did a video and I was talking about how I expected that to shift over Greenland as we lost more and more sea ice, because Greenland would then be the new center of cold, and the center of Greenland is at 73 degrees north, which is offset from the North Pole 17 degrees, right, to the south. And anyway, lo and behold, that's where the polar vortex has been locked over that region. Now, the problem with that is when it is offset, when it's circling the Arctic, it contains the cold air. The jet stream kind of acts as a wall. The cold, dry air is north of it, you know, in the Arctic, and the warmer, humid air is south. And when the jet stream becomes very wavy, you get the cold air excursions far south and the warm air excursions up in the Arctic, causing warming of the Arctic. That's been a big feedback for accelerated warming of the Arctic. But now, if the jet stream actually stays in the position it's in now, the polar vortex, and it's locked over Greenland, then it's completely offset from the pole, 17 degrees. Each cycle of rotation, if you like, is bringing cold air pretty far south and warm air pretty far north. So this is a mechanism, you know, and if you look at the sea ice extent, you know, it always peaks in March. It peaked early this year. It peaked March 3rd, I believe. And if you look at what's happened since then, it's dropping off a cliff. you know, it's plummeting. I mean, we're having drops of 150,000 square kilometers a day, 200,000 square kilometers a day, and that's unheard of for this time of year. I mean, we've just passed the peak. If you Google Arctic sea ice graphs and go to the Arctic sea ice forum, you know, there's a lot of comments. A lot of people are wondering what the heck's going on. And I think the jet stream is now rotating about a different location, center of mass, if you like, or center of rotation, which is centered square over Greenland. You know, if this continues, then I think the probability of blue ocean event this year would be very, very high if this continues. I'm not making a prediction about it that it's going to happen this year. I'm just saying what I see.
Yes, even while we hide in our homes somewhat fearfully, most of us, last week the United Nations said they were postponing their climate activities to focus on the current pandemic, and that is understandable, and you and I are kind of doing that too. But as you say, the temporary clearing of the air is not going to stop the warming of this planet. The poles will keep melting, sea levels will keep rising, we will have severe weather again and again. Can we afford to take a few months or even a year or two off from the battle to contain the pandemic of climate change?
You know, we tend to react when things are right in our face, you know, and this virus is certainly right in our face. People know people that are getting sick. And in fact, when I was in Madrid for the COP25, I got extremely sick the first week of December, and just read a report, an Italian doctor was saying there were lots of cases of people having very unusual symptoms and getting sick back then. And, you know, who knows, maybe it was a strain of the virus circulating already. You know, maybe I have an immunity already. I'd like to get tested and at least find out, you know, the antibodies and see if there is something. Maybe I have, probably wishful thinking, but maybe I have an immunity to it because I had the thing back in December, you know, if it's related. I think we should remind people that self-care is very, very important, more important than ever. You know, make sure you get proper sleep, take vitamin. Vitamin C is supposed to be good. Vitamin D is excellent. I spend about half my time these days outside. I'm outside. I'm jogging. I'm walking. I'm running, especially if it's sunny. You know, I've never been in better shape in years and years and years. And for me, you know, I do with my home office, things haven't changed too much for me. Things haven't changed too much. In fact, I have my kids and my wife around during the day. So I'm not the only one in the house, in a home office, right? So I could argue that things have actually improved for me, right?
That's bizarre. You know, I got somewhat energized by this, and I went out and did a lot of things that I have been meaning to do for years. I got a couple of solar panels, and I did some canning and cleaned up my act. So it can be motivating rather than depressing.
It is. I mean, what it's telling us is that, I'm fitting so much into it each given day now because you never know what you could catch it. And, it puts more urgency on your life and doing things and, trying to be productive and making a doing something. I mean, you and I, we've been trying to save the world for years from climate. Now we have this virus come along and we've switched somewhat because it's a much more urgent thing. But there's so many relations to climate, right? You know, we've come to accept that, you know, climate's been going to hell, but we want to, you know, it doesn't mean we're not going to try to improve things and change things. And it's almost like we're you and I and people that are very concerned about the environment and stuff. We've been through these things already before. It's like we're maybe a bit more resilient, maybe a bit more hardened. We haven't had our heads in the sand about anything at all, right? So, you know, the initial shock with the virus, it's like, oh my God, you know, I've been worried about climate, you know, and it's affected me and whatever. And then this thing comes along, it's like, how does one cope? But, you know, get out there and exercise. Do something you haven't done for years.
And love the one you're with. If you're with somebody. But, you know, we're going to have to wrap it up, Paul. We're running out of time. We have been speaking with Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith. You can find him at paulbeckwith.net. And by all means, subscribe to his YouTube channel to keep abreast of the latest developments. Paul, I want to thank you so much for giving us this update. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening. And let's meet up again next week.
This could be a teachable moment, though it more just looks like a mess. How long the moment might last is anyone's guess. For all of the bold propaganda, what kind of system is best? The moments like this one are the test. Where did they stay ahead of the curve? Where did they just run out of soap? Once the world shut down its borders, which countries were able to cope? Once this pandemic is over.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. Larry Brilliant. Outbreaks are inevitable. Pandemics are optional. In the spring of 2017, at a release party for his book, Sometimes Brilliant, he sketched out the extraordinary voyage from civil rights movement to med school to helping out as physician during the occupation of Alcatraz by the Indians of all tribes. In the Bay Area, Larry Brilliant connected with the psychedelic and music counterculture. He followed the hippie trail from London over the Khyber Pass to India with his wife Elaine, Wavy Gravy, and the Hog Farm Commune. Neem Karoli Baba, one of India's best-known spiritual teachers, told him his destiny was to work for the World Health Organization to help eradicate smallpox. Larry Brilliant became a key participant in eliminating that 10,000-year-old disease that killed 500 million people in the 20th century alone. Smallpox was declared eradicated in 1980. This is a 3-minute clip recorded in March 2017. Larry Brilliant is predicting the deadly mistakes that were made from January 2020 on when the corona pandemic began.
There's sort of a mixed story about pandemics. You know Ebola and Zika, MERS and SARS, Lassa fever, swine flu, bird flu. There's been more animal viruses jumping from animals to humans in the last 30 years than we have records of before. And that's worrisome. But much more worrisome than that is that the institutions that normally keep us safe are sort of AWOL. In the Ebola outbreak, Obama sent 3,500 American soldiers to West Africa. We spent billions of dollars because WHO failed in its job to protect us, because it took 6 months to correctly identify what the disease was that was killing people in West Africa. So WHO is going to have a new director general in May, and I think it's going to go through a period of self-examination, and it's offline. And I think this presidency, as far as pandemics, is offline. You're not going to see public health, let alone pandemic preparedness, at the top of the priority list for this White House. And they fired the head of CDC, and Trump is cutting the budget for public health and pandemic preparedness. So if you look at those agencies that normally keep us safe, the federal government, WHO, the UN, CDC, they're all offline. We have to have a safety net to protect us, to stop pandemics, to end the threat of pandemics. April 7th is World Health Day. It is also the 100th anniversary of the great influenza, the Spanish influenza, the 1917 to 1918 pandemic. One of my grandparents died in that. One of Gerich's grandparents died in that. I wonder how many other people know that in your genealogy, some of your relatives died from that, because somewhere between 25 million and 100 million people died in that 1 year period. And if you put that to today's numbers, you're talking about 75 to 300 million. If we had a pandemic one-tenth of that, one-hundredth of that, it would bring humanity to its knees. There wouldn't be an airplane in the sky for 6 months. Who's going to get on a cargo boat with 300 people whose epidemiological status you don't know when there's no vaccine and no antiviral? I want us to stop the risk of pandemics. We know every step to take. We know how to do it. There will inevitably be outbreaks. There'll be viruses jumping from animals to humans. Outbreaks are inevitable, but pandemics are optional. We don't have to have them if we have the same public will to end them that we had to eradicate smallpox. And that's what I'm hoping that we can pull off next.
That was Dr. Larry Brilliant, recorded in 2017. Now he's sought out for advice on the corona pandemic by media and organizations. On March 24, 2020, he was interviewed by Dr. Daniel Kraft, Chair for Medicine, Singularity University. Here's Larry Brilliant.
So my job today is to spend about 10 minutes, no more, telling you about the entire history of pandemics, at least in the last 100 years, covering everyone in fine detail, and then talking to you a little bit about how this pandemic, COVID-19, how it falls into the spectrum of other diseases like it. Let me start off by saying we are living in an age of pandemics. Not only have we had 6 major global epidemics over the last 100 years, century, but every year, 2 or 3 novel viruses spill over, jump species, jump from animals, jump to humans. And those viruses, the 50 or so that have jumped in the last 30 years, have created many diseases that are recognizable to you, many others whose names you've never heard. A couple of examples: SARS and MERS, bird flu, swine flu, West Nile, Zika, dengue, chikungunya. Why have we entered into an age of pandemics? In part, it's because it's always been like that. There have always been novel viruses jumping from animals to humans. Even a lot of the diseases that we consider endemic, like HIV/AIDS and smallpox, before it was eradicated, were originally animal viruses. But now, in the age of modernity, humans and animals are living in each other's territory more and more. We're cutting down the rainforest. Those animals must go somewhere. Humans have expanded our territory to the edge of forests, to the edge of jungles. We're living closer and closer with animals that we've never integrated our lives before in history, never so much. We not only have more viruses jumping from animals to humans, but now, of course, when they jump, we're there ready with an airplane to help take them all over the world right away. There have been 4 influenza pandemics in the last 100 years. In 1918, we had a pandemic of an influenza virus that was called H1N1. And I apologize, but all of these viruses are named by the neuraminidase and hemagglutinin that they have in the virus. H1N1 is also called swine flu. It was given the unfortunate name of the Spanish flu, although the Spaniards were the ones who behaved well. Every other country was at war during the First World War. And military censorship made countries lie and suppress their disease so they didn't appear their army was weak. Spain was neutral. And when a member of the royal family came down with the disease, it was only natural. In a bout of radical transparency, the Spanish announced that they had this disease in their borders, and forever we awarded their good behavior with giving them the name, which we try not to use anymore. We call it the Great Influenza. Great because it went around the world 4 times in 1 year before there were cruise ships or jet planes, and it infected 1/3 of the population of the world. 1 out of every 3 people of the 2.5 billion then alive contracted this disease, and somewhere between 30 and 100 million people died. Why such a large range? Well, because nobody was counting the deaths in much of Africa, much of China at that time. So we're guessing. In 1957, during the summer of love, going into 1958, we had another pandemic influenza. This one was caused by H2N2, and it caused 1 million deaths. A million deaths compared to 30 to 100 million deaths, but still a million deaths. In 1968, an influenza H3N2, which was called the Asian flu, rattled the stock markets, rattled the global markets, created massive disruption, and killed 1 million people. And then in 2008, our old friend swine flu, H1N1, came back again, and this time it infected one-third of humanity at a time that our population was over 6 billion people. Probably more people were infected by that virus in that time than any other virus in that short a period of time in human history. So four pandemics that were influenza. In fact, some people think of a pandemic almost exclusively as influenza. It is interesting that we don't count seasonal influenza, which every year kills between 300 and 500,000 people. But there are other diseases which, if not pandemics, are pandemic-like. Let's for now call them endemic global diseases. Of course, HIV/AIDS, it's a pandemic to me, but we don't like to think of it in the same way as a rapidly moving influenza pandemic because it moves so slowly. Instead of an incubation period of 1 to 4 days, it might have an incubation period of 6 months. Nonetheless, over 30 million people have died from HIV/AIDS in every country in the world. I think it qualifies in every other way as a pandemic. And of course, I would be derelict in my duty if I didn't mention smallpox. From 1900 to 1980, smallpox killed between 300 million and 500 million. Now, that's not a wordo. I really do mean half a billion people. In fact, smallpox was probably the most lethal disease in human history for an infectious disease. But in 1980, the World Health Assembly declared that we had eradicated smallpox. When we talk later on, I will tell you why I'm an optimist. But the major reason I'm an optimist is that I got to see the last case of smallpox on Earth. A little girl named Rahima Banu, Barishal District in Bola Island in Bangladesh. And when her smallpox lesions fell off of her body and were cooked by the hot sun of Bangladesh, that was the end of a chain of transmission, probably the worst disease in history, stretching back to Pharaoh Ramses V. And if we can eradicate smallpox, I'm confident we can do anything. And that includes COVID. So COVID-19, really COV2, COV2, is the third coronavirus. It's not an influenza virus. The third coronavirus that we have had global epidemics in the last 20 years. In fact, in 2002, we had a SARS outbreak. We had about 7,500 cases and 1,000 deaths. And then we had a MERS epidemic. SARS was a bat disease that undoubtedly infected a intermediary animal. MERS is a disease that stays mostly in camels, but somehow it got exported and got exported into Korea and Thailand. And there were 2,500 cases and 900 deaths. That's a huge case fatality rate. It's a frightening disease. Now we have the third coronavirus. That's why this virus is called COV2. And that's the name of the virus, but the name of the outbreak, the epidemic, is called COVID-19. So what about this particular pandemic? Where does it fit in the rogues gallery of pandemics? This disease is moving very fast. It has a replication value, this inherent number that tells you how many secondary cases are being infected by a primary case, of somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5. every case gives rise to 2.5 or 3.5 more. And since there is exponential growth, that's the exponent. And you can imagine if you give this virus a 3-month head start, you're going to be dealing with tens or hundreds of millions of cases very quickly. We're lucky in that this is not only the age of pandemics, it's the age of technology. So we, for the first time in history, are dealing with a pandemic that we have the tools to conquer. We will more speedily than ever get a vaccine. I'm confident that we will have a vaccine. It may take us 12 to 18 months, but we will have a good vaccine. I'm confident we'll have an antiviral. It'll be faster than the vaccine. I'm confident that that antiviral will work as a therapeutic antiviral. I'm hopeful that it will have vaccine-like characteristics, that it not only cure cases of COVID-19, but prevent others. Now, if that sounds a little strange to you, think about HIV/AIDS. When we first found that it was a death sentence, we thought that it was going to be 100% fatal. Then we developed antiretroviral drugs. Case fatality rate began to drop. It became a disease that you lived with, not died from. Then some very clever scientists reorganized the antiretroviral cocktail, and they found that they could create a preventative antiviral, an antiviral with vaccine-like properties because it could prevent the disease for an individual. So let me leave you with one more thought before I open this up to questions. After the 2008 swine flu pandemic, even though it infected a third of humanity and killed almost a million people, I think some people looked at it like some people are looking now at COVID-19 and said, have we overreacted? We had not overreacted then. We are not overreacting now. But so concerned were a bunch of epidemiologists that people thought we overreacted to swine flu because although it infected a lot of people, it didn't kill so many people. But we were worried that people had forgotten what the pandemic of 1918 or 1957 or 1968 looked like. So my friend Jeff Skoll became the executive producer on a movie. I was the science advisor, and that movie was called Contagion. A lot of people are watching it right now. Some people are telling their children not to watch it because it'll frighten them. I understand that. It has some frightening elements to it. But that virus that we created, which was a little bit of a Nipah virus, a little of a Hanta virus, and mix in a little parainfluenza, that virus is fiction. That virus was much worse than COVID-19. We must keep that fictional virus fiction. We, for the first time in history, have a chance to battle a pandemic with new tools, a new attitude, a new optimism. We must stay optimistic because let the fictional viruses stay in fiction. Let the historical pandemics stay on the dustbin of history. And let's work together to end COVID-19 as fast as we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Larry. You're truly a global treasure, humanitarian and beyond. A couple quick questions. I heard you on CNN last night talking about containment and mitigation. What kind of guidance would you give on the containment and mitigation side right now?
Will you give me a time machine? Because if you would, I would go back 4 months and I would flood the zone with tests. The U.S. has now done almost as many tests as we have cases of COVID-19. South Korea did almost 300,000 tests for a population much smaller than the United States, we've done 1/10 the number of tests. We have been irresponsible in the way in which CDC, my beloved CDC, where I trained and I love dearly, CDC fumbled the ball on creating a test that could get out into the public very quickly. And our government has let us down. Instead of finding a way to have tests so that people could have a pregnancy-like test at home, a pinprick, a little bit of blood, a quick test, a little blue dot that says that you have COVID, a little pink dot that says that you don't have it. If we had that test and it was everywhere, then we could behave rationally. We could find the areas that were still susceptible to finding cases and then going all in on suppression, which we used to call containment. by quarantining everybody. Nobody gets out of the house. You lock down that area. But that idea of quarantining and locking down, that's the wrong strategy for places where there's either a great deal of disease and so much community transmission that you're not going to accomplish very much, or no disease. So we need to go back to the drawing board. We need to follow the virus and put the epidemiological tools that we have to place where they will do the most good. So to me, it's not a question of, are we going to do mitigation or are we going to do containment and suppression? We have to do both.
Are there any sort of tools that we should put into the hands of government or public health officials locally that really could change the game? I mean, we're sort of late, as you said. We don't have a time machine, so we are what we are. What would be in your magic bottle right now if we could pull it out of our hats?
So there's good news and bad news. The bad news is we will not stop this pandemic by social distancing, by any of the steps that we're taking right now. When we try to flatten the curve, bring it down, it isn't in order to reduce the total number of cases that we'll have. Think of your calculus. By moving the curve way two steps to the right, the area under the curve doesn't necessarily change. So why are we doing it? If we're going to have the same number of cases, we do it because we don't want more deaths. Because the deaths that we will have if we have a huge spike that paralyzes all hospitals, the deaths we'll have will be from a heart attack. There'll be trauma deaths that will get to an emergency room and not be allowed in. There'll be people trying to get chemotherapy for their cancer and not have a place to go. We have a lot of deaths and a lot of sick people every year all over the world. If we don't preserve our health system so we can take care of them, that yes, maybe we won't be reducing the number of cases of COVID, but if we don't flatten that curve, we will increase the number of deaths. And that's what we can't do. As doctors, as public health people, our obligation is to reduce human suffering, reduce deaths.
And you learned a lot from your work in India with smallpox. Part of the challenges in healthcare is all these silos and folks not often collaborating. We eventually want to have on our smartphones that immediate viral detection center that can be pan-virus. What might you suggest as we move into the future, as you've done with Skoll Foundation and beyond, to really set the platform for the next pandemic so we have early prevention and response?
Well, we have on our smartphones, and we have what's called Flu Near You in the United States, Flu Tracker in Europe and in Australia. And this is an opt-in bi-directional system. You can get it on the web and look at Flu Near You, and you can see that you have an opportunity to sign up that once a week you'll be asked, are you have a cough? Do you have a fever? Do you have chest pain? Are you sneezing? Have any other feelings, any aches or pains? By doing that, you can screen for both influenza and also for COVID because the symptoms early on are so similar. It'll be launched this weekend with the help of two big technology companies and the CDC. And when it's launched, we hope that everybody will opt in and allow their data to be shared anonymously so that the spot maps will accurately reflect where the disease is. I hope long-term, honestly, we have a stochastic sample, a random sample, and a probability sample, our country, every country, our states, so that we can watch in real time as we create a tracking poll of the virus using incidence, not cumulative prevalence, just incidence. Watch it every day, every week. That's when we'll be able to be smarter about what resources we put in what place.
It's almost like I mentioned earlier in my section, we almost need that kind of Google Maps or Waze where we're all sort of donating data, hopefully anonymously, and we kind of get those early alerts and build that map around us, like Flu Near You or the new one, COVID Near Me, I think, .com or .org, which will allow you to anyone to opt in and get a picture and contribute to that map. So we have that early insight.
That's right. And take a look at Health Map, by the way, which is at Harvard, at Beth Israel Hospital, that John Brownstein has been working on for a very long time. Take a look at that, because on that map, which looks a lot like Google Earth, you can see all the diseases in the world, all the infectious diseases in the world, and what country they are in, and watch as they move from place to place. Not as a voyeur, but to be able to understand, you know, what diseases are coming up and what we need to do as a society to deal with them.
A lot of folks are now physically distancing, some socially distancing. Many folks are not biotech folks or data folks. Any kind of guidance, maybe even from the spiritual realm, you've gone through an amazing spiritual journey with the Grateful Dead and beyond, that could help people through this time. I mean, it takes a village and it takes new mindsets, and you may have some guidance there.
I think of the Grateful Dead song, "Sometimes the light's all shining on me, other times I can barely see." I think that each of us should think about our community and the most vulnerable people in our community, the homeless. Some of us are going out and binge shopping and hoarding. Homeless people cannot binge shop and hoard. Please give money to your food bank. I've watched to see a lot of younger people volunteer with their masks on and their gloves on, socially distancing themselves, bring food to elderly people who are locked up and leave the food in a bag outside of their room. We can make this into something that isn't so much of a psychological burden by helping others. The best way that we can help ourselves is to reach out around and work with the rest of the people in our community. Those who are in America, every county in America has a VOAD, which is a voluntary group that works and puts together all the agencies and all the nonprofits in your county that are working on a disaster. Find a way to volunteer. You can volunteer from home. There are a lot of people who need to be called. They're lonely. There's things that we can do. Don't give up. Don't become a couch potato. Become an activist, even though you have to do it maybe virtually. Maybe there's something to that word virtual.
So just to finish up in the last few minutes, so now we have the chance to sort of connect these dots. You know, you've crossed many different fields from, you know, Silicon Valley to CDC to ashrams. You know, how do we connect these dots faster? And what might, if we wanted to push ahead, let's say to 2025, what kind of world do you think we could create? Because we're going to enter a brave new world after this. It's going to be world 2.0. And maybe your vision of how we're going to sit our pandemic response engine.
Well, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a person of faith. And I believe that in times like this, we have an opportunity to be the best version of ourselves that we can possibly be. And that's the world that I want to see, where each of us finds the best person that we can be, and we live that life. I see a world of more community. Maybe it's virtual for quite a while, but there's no reason that it can't be loving, intimate in the way you can in a virtual streaming world. I'm not disheartened by spending 4 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever the time is, at home. I think of it as a enforced meditation retreat, if we can do that. And it's a time to study, reach out to friends who are lonely and alone, and give them your love and your help. It isn't just the science. It isn't just the innovation of the technology. We need to be human. The virus likes us because we're human. We like ourselves and have to find a way to be the best human beings that we can be.
That was Dr. Larry Brilliant, interviewed by Dr. Daniel Kraft, Singularity University. Brilliant currently serves as the chairman for the Advisory Board for Ending Pandemics. He also works with the charitable organizations launched by the major technology corporations, such as Google and the Skoll Group. He's board certified in preventive medicine and lived in India for more than a decade, working as a United Nations medical officer. He played a key role in the successful WHO campaign to eradicate smallpox in South Asia. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.